Hello, Laughsters, up here at the top with some tragic news. As it turns out, the episode on serendipity is lost to the ether. We ask for your understanding and for privacy as we grieve for an episode that no one will hear. Tis our Atlantis technology issues are, we've lost too many things to technology issues. So if you could just please give Madison and I some time. I guess all we can say is that you weren't meant to hear it. That's what Kate Beckinsale would say. But John Cusack would say, fuck that, you know? You're in charge of your own destiny. And so without further ado, we are moving forward to our episode on the 2009 film My Life in Ruins. So if you have not watched that film because you, like us, were not anticipating to watch anything other than serendipity, please pause and go acquaint yourself with that gem of a film, My Life in Ruins, and come back when you're ready. Or if you want to just wing it, you know, here we go.
Why don't I have a man to fucking feed me fruit? Or really anyone, I'm not picky.
Is it fate or just a date? Bet it's a movie, Chelsea or hate. Mads is here to make her watch it. Either way, grab your popcorn, stay in for the evening. You know what it's time for, Love at First Screening.
Hello, and welcome back to Love at First Screening, the show where usually my friend, co-host, and rom-com enthusiast Madison,
that's me,
introduces me, Chelsea, the resident genre skeptic to all the cliche,
feel good,
questionable,
romantic,
sometimes humorous,
definitely hilarious,
films I've never wanted to watch. This week, however, we're mixing it up. That's right. I'm in the driver's seat, baby. It's time for Cynic's Choice.
Well, Chelsea, sometimes I get a little nervous with Cynic's Choice because I feel like it's a way to... It's a subtle act of subterfuge when it comes to the general genre of this podcast, which is rom-coms. And I'm so proud that you picked this, and it felt so rom-com-y. Like, I almost feel like my bad influence is actually working.
I don't know that your bad influence is working. I just think that occasionally there is a rom-com that I find enjoyable, but they are few and far between, and the ones I would probably list are not ones that many people have seen. They may be aware of other work the creators of that rom-com has produced, like more famous films. So in this case, My Big Fat Greek Wedding, everybody knows. Is it a rom-com? Unclear. But the creators and the leading lady from My Big Fat Greek Wedding is in this movie. There's some other movies where, like, maybe the actors in the film are people you would know, but yet no one's seen that movie, or very few people I meet have seen the movie. I think right now I'm coming across as trying to be very, like, hipster-like, like, oh, I like it because it's not cool, like, and people can't see what I'm doing, but I'm, like, tucking my hair behind my ear the way that a hipster would probably do. I don't know. And that's not the case. I just think that what wins most people over does not win me over.
Mm.
And today for you, we have the gem of a film, My Life in Ruins. It's a little known film from 2009. And to paint a picture for you, I saw this movie in the theaters with my mother in the summer of 2009 when it premiered. I had just moved across the country from Colorado to Florida. I had no friends. And so my mother and I would go to the movie theater on Tuesdays when it was like, I don't know, like $5 to see a movie instead of $10. And my sister famously did not want to go see this movie. She was like, no, thank you. But she does, for the record, enjoy this movie. It was a surprise. I didn't know anything about it. In fact, when my mom had me watch, I don't even know that I watched the trailer. I think my mom just said, oh yeah, it's got the actress, Nia Vardalos. I'm probably butchering that. I'm so sorry. Who is the main character in My Big Fat Greek Wedding. She's like, do you want to go see it? And I just thought, yeah, okay, whatever. Like, I got nothing to do. I'll spend an hour or two at the movie theater with my mom and watching this movie that may or may not be good. And sometimes I think going into things blind gives you the best chance to enjoy it. I think there's some exceptions to that. I think satire can be really difficult to enjoy if you like aren't understanding that it's a satire, but I think in general most films, if you go in not knowing anything about it, you don't have any preconceived notions what you're expecting, and so you're allowed to just watch it and, you know, form opinions about it. I guess to give everyone a synopsis about this film, which maybe they didn't want to spend like $3.99 to rent it, I think it's worth the $3.99. okay,
I would agree.
So My Life in Ruins, starring Nia Vardalos. Again, so sorry if I'm butchering that. I probably am. Nia stars as Georgia, who is a disgruntled tour guide in Greece who has been applying to jobs at universities, particularly in the US, but hasn't gotten any bites. She's a professor of classical history. She's living and working in Greece. And she's stuck in a job where she's getting the same tour participants every single time. It's probably a B or C class tour company, so the accommodations are awful that she's having to stay in. And then she has a fellow tour guide, Nico, who is a kiss ass, always gets the good group, always gets better accommodations, and this isn't even what she wants to be doing with her life. So she's incredibly frustrated. So here we are at her tour with yet another group of all the same people. And she goes through this monologue where she'll say, you know, tipsy Australians, unhappy marriages, off men but still looking divorcees, loud Americans, a bunch of old people, Mr. Funny, right? Like, there's all these archetypes of characters that she had, all these people she has to deal with. And it's, if you've ever worked a customer service job, you've definitely dealt with maybe not these particular people, but whatever your customer service realm is, you have particular people that you have to deal with repeatedly, and you just are like, ay, ay, ay. And she's someone that wants to fill her tours with history because she's a professor and she is trained in this. But people that are coming here for a vacation, they're not really always open to the level of education that she's maybe wanting to provide. And it is on this tour that things are really not going well. She decides she's going to quit her job. She's done, you know, she's not gotten any bites, but she'll figure something else out. She can't handle it anymore. But after a big blow up happens within the group where she inadvertently insults Richard Dreyfuss's character, who is Mr. Funny, she realizes that she's maybe been too harsh on these people, because while they are, yes, falling into those archetypes, they are not the exact same people that she's been dealing with this whole time, and maybe she was a little too harsh. She apologizes, and then she makes more of a concerted effort to help them out, partly because she has quit the job, and so she's kind of flying carefree at this point. It doesn't matter what they say on her evaluation forms, which, by the way, she always receives average, which, as her boss points out, is the lowest box you can check. There is no box that says stinks. If there was, she would get stinks. So she bonds with the tour group through a bunch of shenanigans. They swindle the kiss up Nico tour guide out of his air conditioner for their bus. So now their bus's air conditioning now works when it didn't previously. And through all of this, she falls in love with the bus driver, who is known as Poopy, which is very funny, but he's a very attractive man, has a very different philosophy on life than she does. And by the end of the film, she's gotten a job offer at Michigan University, but she tells her boss, Maria, that she will be staying in Greece because she already has a job. She's going to stay in Greece, continue tours with her new love, who will continue to drive the bus for her. And there you have it. That's My Life in Ruins, in a nutshell. Madison, I don't really even feel like it's fair to say I'm guessing, because you've already kind of stated. So I know that you enjoyed this movie.
Chelsea, I want to let you know the stages that I went through in this movie emotionally. I'm going to lay it all out and then we can dissect it as we go on. We start out and I'm like, okay, standard rom-com vibes. We're rocking. We see Poopy come out, which, by the way, all the poop jokes around the names in this movie, a little much, but fine. Only because that's not my brand of humor. But he comes out and I'm like, oh, he's going to get hot. Don't you worry. And so we're like, okay, standard rom-com. Oh, everything is going wrong for her. And she's talking about how she just can't get with the Greek way of life of, like, you know, shit hits the fan. We dance, we take a break for coffee, we take things in stride. And she's like, I can't take things in stride. I'm very serious. And so I'm like, okay, standard. And then he has the glow up, which I really like. I like when a man has a glow up rather than the woman in the story. I don't know. It just feels like the patriarchy has been chipped away just a millimeter, and it's really hot for me. And then I'm like, oh shit, that guy's my type. All right. And then the movie keeps going, and you just see, and then he's like, I pretended not to know English so I could just listen to you, because it seemed like you needed someone to listen rather than someone to speak with, like, in a back and forth dialogue. You just needed to vent. And I'm like, oh, that's even hotter. He listens. And then you get to the scene where he's shirtless, and that's when I, in a rage, Chelsea, that's the only way I can describe this, in a rage, go to the freezer, get out the Ben and Jerry's fish food, and just start, like, angrily eating Ben and Jerry's fish food ice cream, and just, like, stabbing at it to try to find out the little chocolate fish, because I don't want the ice cream, I just want the little chocolate fish that's in it, and going, you know what, at least I have two men here with me right now, Ben and Jerry, because this guy's so hot and it pisses me off. And then that other annoying guy got his comeuppance, and that's nice. And then there was all the stuff with Richard Dreyfuss's character that I'm like, oh my god, this has so much heart. Like, this movie unexpectedly has so much heart. And it kind of quells, you know, my lady boner of sorts. And then we get to the end of the movie and I'm like, damn, that was good. At the beginning, I thought it had some pacing issues, but once I started rage eating ice cream and we really, you know, got to the meaty heart of it all, I was like, fuck, this movie caught me unawares. That's my evaluation for you. I don't know where you want to start with that. The man's glow up, Irv's amazing self, the way that she figures out that, you know, she kind of embraces this Greek way of life, this passion, this kefi, if you will, to use a term from the movie. Where do you want to start?
I think there's something for everyone in this movie, because unlike your stereotypical run-of-the-mill rom-com, which in many ways I do think this film falls into, I think this movie is a lot more balanced with comedy and the romance than a lot of rom-coms are. I think a lot of rom-coms, understandably, you're putting romance before comedy, even though alphabetically that's not the case, right? But there's generally more romance involved in those films. But I think that this movie really leans into, because you've got a whole cast of characters to provide comedy. And some of these characters you will roll your eyes at, and some of them you will give a half-hearted chuckle to, and then some of them will catch you off guard in a moment. You're like, that is so funny and brilliant. One of my favorite moments is when they're in, I think, a cathedral of some kind, and the British doctor and her husband and her teenage daughter, they're wanting their picture, and the teenage daughter Caitlin has been upset and sullen and sulking this whole entire time, typical for a 16-year-old who doesn't want to be on a trip with their parents, although I would have been so excited to be in Greece even if I was with my parents at 16, but maybe I'm a different teenager. Anyway, the father's originally taking the photo, and then Richard Dreyfuss's character, Irv, comes over and is like, oh, why don't you get in there? I'll take a photo of all of you. And so they're, you know, posed in front of part of this cathedral. And Irv starts counting. And he's like, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. He just keeps going. And finally, the father's like, I'm so sorry. Where are you counting to? And he's like, I'm counting until the kid cracks a smile. And then he says, oh, I lost my place. Gotta start again. And then he just starts counting. He keeps going. And then both of the parents get frustrated and angry, and then Caitlin finally laughs. And so the photo that they get is them being angry and their kid looking happy. And it's just, I don't know. I still think about it, and I think I think Richard Dreyfuss's character is the kind of person that you hate in customer service, because yes. He's cracking a bunch of jokes that aren't funny, but that one in particular I find so amusing. It did exactly what he wanted to, and I don't know, it's just so funny.
Just on the frame of this movie is heavy with comedy in comparison to the romance.
Yeah, so like there's moments like that where, and again, I feel like it's an ensemble cast, which is unusual for a rom-com. Usually you have your main people and then you have like a cherry-picked cast of side characters that really only serve to propel the plot forward. But I feel like in this case, by virtue of what she does for a living and who this cast of characters is, you're allowed to have a large cast, and it makes sense. When people fade into the background, you don't notice as much, because as opposed to having like a best friend character where you're like, why isn't she talking to her best friend about this monumental life decision? Instead, like, the plot has her isolated. She's on a tour bus 6 days a week. The people she socializes with are her clients, the people taking the tours. As I said previously, I think now that she's decided to quit her job, she does kind of throw her professionalism slightly out the window. Either that, or she's just really reached a breaking point. I mean, I think it's both.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think for me, it's easier to enjoy these characters because I'm not questioning why they're not more or less involved in certain situations. Because ultimately, they're all strangers. I mean, they do have to rely on her a certain amount because she is their tour guide and they are in a foreign country. And they don't, or at least the majority, if not all of them, do not know the language, and she's in charge of the itinerary and their accommodations and yada yada yada. So I think in that respect, it's different from your, at least from the setup of your average rom-com. And I do think that there is a lot more leaning into comedy. I think it's more evenly split. The romance is still very prevalent, I want to be clear. It's definitely a major plot point. And it's a major plot point in Georgia's turn in terms of what she's finding important in her life. And as you stated, and as the film stated, she's like finding her spirit, her Kefi.
Yeah, I think where this really kind of shines and is set apart, and I think back to other movies that we've watched where, I mean, this is definitely true as well, but not nearly to the same degree or prevalence. I think what's really refreshing about the comedy in this movie is that there are comedic elements built into the romance itself, but the comedy to me almost feels largely, I don't really want to say separate, but I suppose more parallel to the romantic story itself. And I just find that more enriching because it adds depth to the plot. And I mean, we'll get to it later when we discuss if this is in fact a rom-com, but I like that there are just external motivations that comes along with how the humor is built in. And it also, I think the comedy itself, in another way that I find really refreshing, is that it doesn't really poke at the romance itself. The comedy, by and large, doesn't really poke at the relationship, because I also feel like romantic comedies can reach a level of like self-deprecation with how the relationships are set up and how we want to deploy the comedy within that. And I really like that this romance just kind of blooms, so to speak, because the main love interest is giving Georgia flowers secretly all the time, and I just think that was really cute. But the romance kind of blooms in this slow burn way that you also don't really get a lot in rom-coms, especially with, I mean, because this is pretty close to a tight 90, right? Like, this is a very succinct film.
It is a tight 90.
So this is a really succinct film. I will say that I felt like it had some pacing issues in the very beginning. It was very slow to build. I mean, this is like a real slow burn, as much as you can get in an hour and a half long movie. But it paid off in, you know, absolute dividends. And yeah, I think that I won't get into it yet, but just the way that everything kind of runs parallel in this movie with all these different plot lines with the ensemble cast that you referenced. I mean, there are characters that I'm just kind of like, yeah, what was their point? And they just have like little bits here and there. They weren't standout, but I didn't feel like any of the characters introduced were wasted ultimately. Like, they all felt really valuable too, which is hard. Like, it's really hard for,
yeah,
you know, these characters who, honestly, like, I'm thinking about like the divorcees who have sworn off men but are still looking, the obnoxious Americans, Gator, the Floridian. They probably had the most minor roles out of, but I can still recall them really well and recall their importance. Honestly, the only, like, the biggest throwaways that I can think of are probably the tipsy Australians, but, like, you gotta throw the Australians in if you can't get the Canadians. It's just kind of a rule.
You know, it was funny rewatching it. I noticed that the, you know, Nico's group, the rival tour guide, he has a bunch of Canadians. And this is something that happens at the beginning of the film as she's pointing out to her boss that, you know, she's having the exact same people on every single tour. Like, oh, look at them as they're, you know, getting ready to start the tour. And she sees Canadians and she's like, oh, can I have them? And then her boss is like, no, they're in Nico's group. And I noticed that these Canadians in question are decked out in a lot of Canadian national garb, mm-hmm. if you will. They have the Canadian flag on the things they're wearing, which feels very odd for Canadians. It actually feels very odd for anyone outside of the United States. I feel like the United States being the country that it is, people rep United States flag stuff mm-hmm. all the time. It's very typical for an American to go abroad and wear a t-shirt with the flag on it. It's like, ah, so you know Americans. And so I have some questions about this. I feel like as a plot device in the movie, you're just identifying them as Canadians. Like, that's how she knows they're Canadians, looking out the window, they're wearing the Canadian flag. But then I thought, well, maybe is it smart to do that? Because if Americans aren't liked in other parts of the world, which we're not, are the Canadians trying to differentiate themselves as English-speaking white folks from the
Honestly,
Americans?
Honestly, I feel like if I wouldn't be able to pull it off, especially if I was drinking, because I don't have a super much of an accent on the podcast in terms of a southern accent, but there are certain words that I say and I'm like, oh shit, that's like, that would be a dead giveaway. But I feel like if I was gonna wear any nationality's flag abroad, I would probably go with Canadian. That way people liked me more, you know. I could never picture myself wearing anything like any American paraphernalia abroad, because I don't want to be instantly disliked. But there are certain words that I feel like if I was made to say them, I just out myself immediately. And then the Canadians also outed themselves by running into a sign and then patting it to make sure that it was okay. So polite.
Madison, there is one thing I want to point out about this film that I don't love.
Uh-oh, you could pick so many things of, like, the era. Go for it.
Well, yeah, there's lots of things, and most of them I more easily roll my eyes and be like, yeah, okay, this film's from 2009, and occasionally you can tell. But the one thing that, like, really bugs me is Nico giving mm-hmm. that shirt mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. Gator. Mm-hmm. So Nico, the rival tour guide, not a nice guy, routinely trying to make George's life miserable, like, in the very first scene where they are all on the bus, he mistakenly, in air quotes, gets on her bus with these donuts and is like, oh, I'm so sorry, wrong bus, which immediately makes her look bad to this new group of people, right? So he's constantly doing things like this. And one thing he does probably midway through the film is he pulls Gator, the like college age Floridian guy, by himself. He pulls him aside and he's like, I got you this present, and it's a shirt that has Greek writing on it with like these two Greek men that kind of look like they're attacking each other or wrestling. I don't know. They're like kind of, they're not, they're just like slightly elevated above stick figures. It's not a super detailed drawing, but it has Greek writing on it. And Gator's like, oh, what does it say? And Nico tells him it says, I love Greece. And so Gator's like, oh, thank you. And Nico's like, don't tell anybody because I can't buy for everybody, but whatever. Should seem highly suspect that this tour guide would get this random guy a shirt, but fine. So later, he's wearing the shirt. They're at a hotel bar outside by the pool, and Gator is in a conversation with these two Greek men, and they're drinking and having what seems to be a great time, when people kind of notice that Gator might be in a situation that he doesn't realize he's in. And Georgia goes over there to tell him that his shirt does not say, I love Greece. It says, enter at rear. And this is where you have to be like, ugh, because this is 2009, playing on the heterosexual fear that they will be preyed upon by homosexuals and gay people. And as soon as Georgia says what it says, they flash to the two Greek men that Gator's having a conversation with, and they're like licking their lips, and it feels very predatory. Mm-hmm. And I am very uncomfortable with this particular plot point. And then they all end up attacking Nico. So I can say, at least in some respect, that while Gator does seem shocked and possibly slightly disgusted by the fact that these two gay men thought that he was also gay, he doesn't attack the men. He goes and pushes Nico into the pool. And it's like played off as a joke, and it's not supposed to be taken seriously. But here we are, what, 15 years later almost? I just can't help but feel like it's important to explain why these things aren't funny, or that there's a joke, but like, here's the sinister undertones of the joke. Because we don't live in a world where everything is hunky-dory. We don't. And these things live on in perpetuity, right? Like, this film remains the same no matter what. And I don't think that we need to go back and change films that are problematic. And I don't think we should avoid watching them, but I do think it's important to explain and call out why jokes aren't okay and what's wrong with the way that certain things are portrayed. And this is a small moment in this film, and it's the only thing that really makes me in my gut uncomfortable about this movie. There are other things I'm definitely rolling my eyes at and I'm like, oh my God. But this is the one that, like, really gives me pause. So I just wanted to mention it. I just wanted to throw that out
there. Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. That also was the only thing that really stuck with me. Is like, oh, that's icky. I don't like that at all. And I think, too, it's just potential hot take sort of tangent here with that. There's a lot of discussion in politics. It has been since gay relations have been under fire, etc. Also, I do want to point out that there is a running hilarious joke to me. It's funny to me, I'll put it that way, where it's like the Greeks invented sex, and then the Romans pointed out that you could have it with women too. Just funny little clip there. But I just, there's all this discussion around how queer people are like groomers or predators, etc. Even statistically, that's just wildly, wildly untrue on you know, any real scale. But I think it's really interesting that they choose this and, you know, paint this as predatory. But if you had changed it to where, you know, if Gator had been a woman, and, you know, his shirt, you know, her shirt in that instance had said basically, like, down to fuck, and she didn't know when there are all these guys who were, like, swarming her, the joke changes so significantly in how our culture would perceive that. And those men would not be seen as predatory in that way. They'd just be misled. And so I'm really grateful that it ended up that, you know, Nico kind of got the end of the fist in this situation. But I just also can't help but, like, further hone in on that point of, like, it's only because in this instance that it is gay men approaching a straight man, a Floridian at that, that this becomes the magnitude of the situation that it is. And then there's also others. I mean, there's just like classic 2009 shit stuff about like body image and stuff like that. That is just like, what is the point? Much along the lines of, you know, banging and bucks ain't your business, bodies ain't your business. And I just always want people to fall back on the idea that, like, I want you to keep in mind that if you're a person who enjoys having physical relationships with people and you've had that relationship, anytime you feel bad about your body, just be like, you know what? That person saw me without my clothes and didn't tell me to put them back on. So that's a tick in that box. Am I right? On that topic, I really do, like, with the exception of that scene with Gator, I really like how the idea of sex is approached in this movie. It's not really humorous in that it's like, you know, it is kind of jokey, but more in like a high five kind of way rather than like, you know, a something's gotta give sort of farcical way. And also just go Irv. If you've seen the movie, you know what I mean. And go Irv. I'm really, really proud of him for sowing his wild oats, as his late wife says, when he, what, has a heart attack, I'm assuming. Which also, very touching moment there. Like, I thought that guy was a goner after that scene. And I think, you know, there's the running joke with Irv that he's either a god or he's, you know, an oracle, he's psychic, he's magic, like there's all these things. And I want to ask you if you feel like the magic of Irv is actually just imparting the wisdom of a life well lived. I think that gets really hammered home in the Delphi scenes. But yeah, I want to hear your thoughts on Irv in greater detail.
I think the magic of Irv, and I mean this both in the frustrated way, but also in a positive way, is he is a man who has lived a life, and he's importantly a white man, and he can just make these jokes.
A white man?
No! No, like, he can be carefree. He's free of the imposter syndrome that so many of us suffer from. He's not self-conscious, and whether that's because he's a man, he's white, he's of a certain age, it's probably all three. But I feel like in an important way within the context of this film, he is able to be silly. And because he's being silly, he's getting people in on it, you know? And so instead of it being an imposing figure making everyone feel smaller, he's in some ways opening the door for people to join him and be silly and do the crazy things, run the crazy shenanigan plays, steal the air conditioner from Nico's bus. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I think that's really fun. And I do think what you said is true. I think he's lived a life and he is imparting wisdom. A lot of these people are either having too much fun or not enough, right? Like those seem to be the two camps that all of these characters fall into. Georgia is not having enough fun. She is very hung up on the rules and guidelines and history, and she doesn't want to deviate from her path. But ultimately, by doing so, she makes a better tour, right? Like, that's her journey in this. You know, the 16-year-old Caitlin not having enough fun, her unhappily married parents not having enough fun. But importantly, when Dr. Tullin comes out of the beach, she comes out in her swimsuit and like she looks great, and everyone's like, oh, that was worth the wait. But like, she's pushing herself outside of her comfort zone. And it's when people do that, when they push themselves outside of their comfort zone, that they seem happier, they seem more relaxed. And so I think Irv, be it just because he's the one blazing that trail on this particular tour, but he's offered people the key to getting themselves out of the cages that they have themselves in, and the prescribed roles that they have, that they're playing, right? Because I stated previously that all of these characters are filling some kind of stereotype. They're playing an archetypal role, not just in Georgia's life, but also, right, like the Americans that say, oh, does he speak American, you think? So ridiculous. And the uptight British people, the divorcees, but they're still interested, which like why shouldn't they be? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And yeah, so it's just people get to leave those roles. I simultaneously love Irv and roll my eyes at him the other half of the time. Yeah. You know, that's just the kind of character that he is.
Irv is like when you're getting older, your mid-20s, 30s, etc. You know, if you're privileged enough to, you know, have a good relationship with your dad and still have him around and everything like that. Irv is like that dad figure where you're like, Jesus Christ, with the dad jokes and the, you know, kind of, you know, occasionally butting into situations where you're like, where the fuck did you even come from in this? But you also stay up late at night and talk about crazy life theories, and you listen to stories that were the stories that you finally get to hear that you always heard. I'll tell you when you're older, when you were growing up, and then you're finally older and you can hear those stories. That feels like Irv's character in a nutshell. Irv is like that stereotypical kind of wacky dad character. I think what he really unlocks in Georgia, and what Poopy also unlocks, it just kills me to say that every time. I want you to know it absolutely slays me dead. But I think what they both kind of work to unlock in her is something that exists that perhaps has just gotten dimmed over time, both with cynicism but also this devotion to doing something right, because she's very good at her job in a technical way. You know, she's a professor of classical history. And so she's really the ideal person to be running these tours because she knows everything you could want to know. But at the same time, because she's gotten so technical with it, there's no heart in it. It's sort of like when you hear someone who plays an instrument really, really well and they're just going through the motions. It doesn't sound the same as when they're really enjoying it. And that's the real thing that I think Irv kind of embodies, is he embodies doing something well, but he embodies doing it for yourself in the way that is meaningful to you rather than ticking all the boxes. And I think, honestly, Georgia is just a perfect example of what happens when you try to monetize your passion, when you try to turn your passion into a career and you get burnt out. Maybe two someones in this conversation. Maybe three somebodies. I'm talking to you, person listening to this. Maybe you know this feeling too. That's part of what makes this movie universal.
I also just want to point out a couple of just lovely things. So we have Dorcas, who is
Dorcas is my hero.
She's this old woman who is constantly giving people things, and probably like three scenes in, you realize that she is straight up stealing all this stuff. She gets back onto the bus with necklaces for the divorcees, and Georgia is able to get the bus driver to go so that she doesn't get caught. But then she ends up being instrumental in the plan to swindle the air conditioner from Nico because she steals the keys. She's a pickpocket.
I love her so much.
You know, so anyway, shout out to Dorcas, who is incredibly charming, an old woman and a thief, and we love her. Also, we have the man who Georgia mistakenly thinks is leaving her the flowers, who is,
oh my god, Mr. IHOP,
who is like a sales rep, is constantly talk about making your job your personality. He is constantly bringing up breakfast foods. And then also, I want it known that his little monologue about syrup, I used that for my musical theater audition in high school. when Georgia mistakes Poopy's advances and thinks that they're Mr. IHOP's, she goes and she sits down at the bar with Mr. IHOP, and he just starts talking about how he collects vintage syrup, and it's like a montage, and she's slowly just like falling asleep. The bartender starts drinking because it is so boring. That man did turn his passion into his job.
He did. Except
it seems to be working for him. So,
okay, look, all I could think during that entire scene was like, thank God that Georgia did not have the unfortunate incidents of like going to bed with that man, because that would have been a very sticky situation in that I'm pretty sure he would have incorporated maple syrup into that as well. So, but you know what, actually, Chelsea, I'm going to plug something really quick because this is a perfect place to plug it. If you have ever been on a date where you feel like you have basically reenacted this scene where a man is droning on to you for hours about fucking maple syrup of all goddamn things, or something, you know, nothing like that, but an equally horrible date, I would love it if you would submit your horrible date story to us, and we will plug how to do that at the end of the podcast. That's my little plug for a future episode.
Love it. Can't wait to read about terrible dates, be they related or not, to syrup.
And you know, Chelsea, if no one writes in, it's just going to be a really, really sad hour of me recounting the worst dates I've ever been on. I just thought of three off the top of my head. Christ. They shouldn't have come that readily. That means it didn't take me any time to think about them. They're just permanently lingering there.
Well, Madison, if you don't have anything more to say about this movie, I think we must determine whether it is or is not a rom-com.
I do actually have one more thing to say, and that is facial hair, whether it be there or the lack of it, entirely changes a person. And I think I understand now, in a way, why no one connected Clark Kent with Superman with the whole like glasses situation, because it's basically the same thing of a man growing or shaving a beard. That's two different people. You can't tell me otherwise. Yeah, that's it. That's my last statement. Basically, the men know how to shapeshift, and we must tell the church.
I have the church's contact info, so we can make that call.
Beep, 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 beep. Yes, I'll hold. Okay, so it says the wait hour is like 6 hours and 66 minutes, which is actually 7 hours and 6 minutes. So I'm a little disturbed that they chose that. anyway, so yeah, Chelsea, did you bring us a rom-com for this Cynic's Choice? Methinks you did. But I'll let you ask me the questions.
Well, Madison, do they date?
So I'm assuming that the they is Georgia and Poopy. I want you guys to know that I pause every time after saying that because I roll my eyes.
For the record, in case anyone didn't watch the movie, his name is Prokopi, but he goes... So it's a choice I think is important. It's a choice. He goes by Poopy.
Yeah.
Which, Poopy, to be fair... Yeah, Poupikakos is his name. To be fair, he is Greek, and perhaps I think Poopy is just a name, and it doesn't sound like a word in English that is gross potty time talk, you know?
Oh my god, gross potty time talk is like, that was like the most like parental adult thing I've ever heard you say. Like, that phrase in particular is like exactly how you talk to a small child when you want them to stop talking about shit at the dinner table. Just be like, no, 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 that is gross bathroom talk, and we're not using that right now. We can talk about that later. Chelsea, are you sure that you're not the ultimate aunt? Because I'm getting pretty sure. I mean, you're certainly the aunt to one of the cutest kids ever made that I got a picture of today, that you also got a picture of today. So shout out to that child in particular.
He's really freaking cute.
He's perfect. But back to the topic. Yeah, no, they definitely date. I mean, it's a slow build. I honestly almost want to quantify like their first date to be when she's ranting and venting at him to him when she thinks he doesn't speak English, and they're going and just kind of going about their day on the tour when it's not going so well. Actually, I'll tell you exactly when I paused the movie to go rage eat Ben and Jerry's while I watched it. And it was the scene where he's by the water and has a fucking guitar, and he starts feeding her fruit. Actually, it was the exact scene where he starts feeding her fruit, and I go, why don't I have a man to fucking feed me fruit? Or really anyone. I'm not picky. Well, I am, but not like that. So I went and got ice cream, and I fed myself ice cream since I didn't have a hot Greek man playing guitar to feed me fruit by hand. But yeah, so they definitely date is what I'm trying to say.
Did we laugh I think we've already stated that we did.
And I think this, what I wanted to bring up here, though, I wanted to ask you how, obviously we laughed, and obviously the comedy was not only central to the plot, but it just felt very intentional in what it was doing. And it had tiers of jokes, everything from poopy caucus to, you know, much, much higher level humor throughout this. And I wanted to ask you, do you feel like, I guess, as almost a revision of the question of did we laugh, you know, was there intentional comedy sort of crucial to the development of the tone of the movie? What are your thoughts on the comedy kind of running parallel to the romance itself? Because this is something that we really haven't deeply encountered much in the films that we've watched.
I do think the majority of the comedy runs parallel in that it's happening outside of the romantic plot. And I think if it was entirely that way, I wonder if we would feel like instead of this being a romantic comedy, it's a, like, it's a romance and a comedy, you know what I mean? Like, if it's,
yeah,
those two things are separate. But we do have comedy that is directly related to the romantic plot. Her mistaking Mr. IHOP as the person sending her romantic advances is something that is happening multiple times up until the incredible syrup monologue that Mr. IHOP has that totally kills her interest in him. And I do think even with Georgia and Poopy themselves, as they are kind of navigating, obviously they're going to get together, but like at what point, there is her rambling to him thinking he doesn't speak English and professing that she hasn't had sex in forever. And at that moment, him choosing to reveal that he does in fact speak English by saying forever is a really long time.
Yeah.
It's him having a glow up when she basically says he looks like a werewolf and like, what is it, a full moon? And then, you know, he shaves his face for her and then she like doesn't notice until way later that he even shaved his face. I think there are small moments like, so I do think that there is comedy related to the romance, but I do think that this movie just has so much comedy in it that there's so much outside of it. Whereas I think in what we were stating earlier is that a lot of romantic comedies, the comedy takes a back seat to the romance. I feel like in this movie, you have the comedy that is facilitating the romance or helping it along. And then you also have additional comedy.
Yeah. I think this might be one of the most comedy-packed rom-coms that we have watched.
Yeah, for sure.
Now, going on our fourth season. Which just means that you're better at picking out funny movies, I think is the real heart of this statement. But yeah, I think that this movie did all of it so well. I also have to point out, I laughed out loud right at the beginning of the movie when Georgia finds out that Poopy is going to be her driver. And she's like, oh, she's talking to the tour company manager. And she's like, oh, does he even speak English? And like, he's so hairy and weird and whatever. And the manager's like, yeah, it's almost like someone taught like a dog or like a wolf or whatever to drive. And, you know, that's what happened. Like, maybe he's not even a person. Maybe he's just a dog who knows how to drive. And I don't know, but that like really tickled my funny bone. There are just some really good one-liners through this. Yes, hard check mark, double check mark, triple check mark for comedy.
And then last but not least is love in the driver's seat. Is romance what is propelling the story forward? And this seems to be the question we struggle, or I should say our films struggle to confidently pass, because is this a rom-com, Madison? Because while the romance is integral to her storyline, it's not the only thing that is transforming Georgia's perspective on life.
It's very true. I would argue, though, that I think the best way to tackle this question with this movie specifically is to gauge her evolution, and it's what got her to her final point by looking at her final decision. Her final decision in the movie is to not take the job in Michigan, which, by the way, why the fuck would you move to Michigan when you live in Greece? I digress. No shade to Michigan. I'm sure it's fine. I have a grudge against someone who was from Michigan, so you know who you are. But you don't listen to this, hopefully. Or maybe you do, who knows. But I think when we look at what she decided to do at the end, which is stay in Greece, part of that is that she has sort of adapted to the Greek lifestyle that she's kind of been resisting up to this point. She's fallen back in love with what she's doing. And then, of course, there's the guy. She has this new relationship, and it all boils down to this idea that why would she change her life so dramatically when she has reached this new and previously undiscovered degree of happiness? And I would argue that he was able to really open her eyes a lot. He's definitely part of the reason why she's staying. So to a degree, I would say that if we look at what drove her to her final decision as, you know, this sort of Telios of the movie, of her transition into her final evolution, I would say that it's a combination of falling in love with him, falling in love with Greece, and falling in love with her passion. And so in a way, I'm gonna say yes, romance is driving this plot, because I think there is something romantic about falling in love with where you are, or where you've decided to plant yourself, where you have found yourself planted. I think it's a very romantic notion in and of itself, and then you add in that hot Greek guy. Oh.
I will agree with you that it is a rom-com. Like, I do think this passes, and I think you've kind of illustrated why it passes. I don't think it passes on the romance alone. I think it is set up this kind of triangular structure that all equally support her. And so if you took away the romantic through line, then the stool topples over.
Yeah.
Is it enough? Now, part of me wants to push back, because I think the reason I'm able to buy that she's passing up a job she's been working so hard for, like, it's known that she took this job, you know, it was only supposed to be temporary while she looked for a university position. And like, here we are, many years later, she's still there. She's unhappy as ever, right? The way that I'm able to get behind her decision to stay is because of the other ways in which she has fallen in love with Greece and her job, and not just this guy. Because, look, I think they're cute. They seem to be having fun, but they don't know each other all that well.
No, he's like 25% of the decision.
Yeah. I think that's why I don't even want to say that, like, oh, well, she chooses to stay and be with the guy in the end, because I don't really think she does. I think she chooses to stay because she fell back in love with the place she was in, and she was able to connect to the people she was serving in a way that she hadn't been previously. She was able to let go of some of the rules that were holding her back. She was able to become more flexible, and as a result, she was better at her job. And if you're better at your job, you probably like it a little bit more. You're not having that friction she was previously, where it's like, people were like, yeah, okay, she's average, but I also really didn't like the tour. But I can't say I didn't like the tour. I can just say the tour was average, which ultimately means forgettable, which leans back into, and honestly transitions us to our next set of questions, which is, how would you rate this movie on a scale from good, great, or average? Because ultimately, I think that sometimes movies that are, or any, and an experience in general, be it a movie, a book, or like a trip that you took, if it's average, you're gonna forget it. And in some ways, that feels worse. Don't get me wrong, I would much rather watch some of those forgettable movies than some of the movies I've truly hated that you've had me watch. But in terms of its mark on the world, the forgettable ones didn't leave a very lasting impression.
Oh yeah, no. I mean, I think to the fact of how many books, I mean, think about how many books between the two of us we have probably read up to this point in our lives. And then also think about how many we can recall in any like real detail. And it's not because we didn't enjoy them, and it's not because we didn't understand or, you know, contextualize them in any way. It just really comes down to the idea that there are We don't bother with the unremarkable. It just, it doesn't serve us in daily life. And I think this movie, for me, feels, I'm not going to call it remarkable in that, oh my gosh, this was revolutionary, life-changing, I'm going to make it my favorite movie. But it was so dynamic in how many components it was able to incorporate that this is definitely a standout for me of all that we've watched. I would say that I will probably be referencing this one in future episodes. I feel like they're a movie, like when I recommend to people that they listen to our podcast, you know, people always ask, where do I start? Like, I had someone recently who texted me and was like, I'm super behind on your podcast, but I want to listen to an episode when I drive to work on Wednesday. Can you send me like your favorite from up to this point that you've released recently that I probably wouldn't have heard? And I was like, yeah, listen to the Gay Pirates one. That's the one to listen to. And I think, like, even, like, we spent a whole season coming up with storylines. And I could probably name, like, 4 of them to you. And we did 12?
Yeah.
So I would say that this movie is no Gay Pirates. But this movie is potentially a slightly older woman moving to potentially a cult. Like, that's the vibe. And if you've listened to season 3, you'll understand that reference. If you haven't, that's okay. Just know that I basically just called this movie a 4 out of 5.
Yeah, I have similar feelings. I really enjoy this movie. I would say this is solidly a 4. It's one I feel happy to watch again, and it's also one I like to introduce people to, especially because everybody knows and loves My Big Fat Greek Wedding, and yet no one's ever seen this movie. And so I'm constantly like, you have to watch this one because it's also really good. So yeah, I think it's solidly a 4.
This is a movie that you can show your dad.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. This is one, as I think I said earlier, I think there's something in this movie for everyone. I think regardless of if you're a rom-com lover, a rom-com hater, or completely indifferent to the genre, if you like to laugh, I think It's just a good movie to watch. It's not perfect, but I don't really think people need movies to be perfect all the time. This is a solid 4. It's A for effort, made some really good points, but aren't necessarily winning any awards. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's fine.
It's an absolute Richard Dreyfuss sleigh. It's really what we're trying to say. Even though I think, you know what? Richard Dreyfuss's character just really sums up my feelings about this movie. There are moments when you're like, what the fuck? All right, fine. I guess you decided to do that. And then you're also like, oh my God, that touched my heart. And that's it.
Madison, what are we watching next week?
Oh my gosh, what a good question. So I'm back in the saddle, so to speak, next week. And we are going to go with a movie that I have actually had someone ask me for because it is classic Richard Gere, classic Julia Roberts. I know what you're thinking. We already covered Pretty Woman. We did, but we haven't watched Runaway Bride yet. And we're going to do that.
I've heard of this movie.
It's, yeah. Okay, that's it. You'll hear next time.
Anytime you are not confident, it makes me so nervous about what I'm gonna watch.
I know. Sometimes I feel like I should just set that up just for fun. But yeah, so we're gonna watch Runaway Bride, check it out, and circle back with us, to use a disgusting corporate phrase. Let's circle back next week on this.
If you do want to circle back, you can, of course, email us, loveatfirstscreening@gmail.com. Shoot us a DM on Instagram, @loveatfirstscreening, where you can recommend movies you want us to watch and add to future seasons. And also, that's where you can contact us to provide your terrible date stories, and we are asking to receive those by May 7th. So if you can tell us all the details, you can change them, you know, you can change people's names to
anonymize it, or don't, it's you.
Or don't, you know, if you want us to air your dirty laundry, we would be happy to do so.
And I also want to give a huge shout out. As of now, we actually just got, you know, blast from the past for you, just got the new intro song for our podcast done by the artist Good Steph, GoodSteph, Good Steph. And I screamed and giggled like a small child on the playground when she sent it to us. So shout out to Good Steph. You can find her music anywhere you can stream music. You can find her on Instagram at Good Steph. And yeah, listen to If I Had a Heart or Call Your Mom. That's the song, but also 10. Call Your Mom. Yeah. You know what? Call your mom and tell her to listen to Good Steph.
There you go.
Chelsea, I'm so happy. This is such a good movie. Thank you for this.
You're welcome. Thank you for watching a better movie with me for once. And thank you all for joining us on this episode. We hope you come back next week. We hope you listen to Good Steph, who did an incredible job. We only just got the theme song. We've only just listened to it, and it's incredible. I know you've all been enjoying it all season long, but lucky you. We only just got it. It's so great. I listened to it. I can't even tell you how many times. But yeah, thank you all for joining us. We'll be back with you next week for Brides Who Run Away, maybe? I don't know. I haven't seen the movie yet. But until next time, call your mom and listen to Call Your Mom.
Call your mom, take no shit, and do no harm. Good stuff.